With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Dylan Evans tells us about his Utopia experiment, and then Andrew Muller on his memoir, It's Too Late to Die Young Now. Dylan Evans is an academic, philosopher and journalist. He's written several popular science books and was once described in the Times as the sort of polymath who makes you wonder what you've been doing with your brain. He currently lives in Guatemala and he's the author of The Utopia Experiment, which we're going to be talking about today. So, Dylan, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, the beginning of this book finds you in a psychiatric hospital, and you describe thinking about how to describe why you're there to other patients and how crazy that would sound. So by way of telling us what the book's about, can you summarize why you're in that hospital?
So yeah, I mean, I wanted to start off the book in a sense with kind of almost the end of the story, because it's more about, you know, a why done it than a what did I do. So yeah, I ended up in this psychiatric hospital in 2007 because I'd set up this post-apocalyptic commune, as it were, in Scotland to imagine what life might be like if civilization had collapsed. And ironically, civilization didn't collapse, but I did. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up in this psychiatric ward.
So the original idea was that it would be a sort of simulation, and you had a scenario. Tell us about the scenario that you wrote to attract people to the project.
Sure. So the idea was that, well, civilization, our modern global high-tech world, seems very secure and solid, but, you know, many civilizations in the past have collapsed, and they probably seem just as solid and secure to the people who were alive at the time. And I began to wonder, this was about 10 years ago, began to wonder what would happen, you know, if global warming and peak oil and financial crises all sort of came together and caused our modern global civilization to collapse. And I began to think, well, you know, maybe one way to find out what life would be like for the survivors would be to act it out. So I wrote this brief scenario in which I described how at the the first decade of the 21st century, a combination of all these pressures on global civilization caused the whole thing to collapse. And the cities imploded, most people died, but there was a few survivors who managed to sort of get out just in time. And they set up this mm-hmm. sort of community in the Scottish Highlands to try and survive.
And this wasn't just, I guess, idle speculation on your part, although as it happens, the scenario that you write does not involve your previous work with artificial intelligence, but you did, before this happened, work in artificial intelligence and were sort of somewhat taken by the work of technologists like Bill Joy and Kurzweil and the singularity idea and things. So let's talk about that idea of technological collapse.
Yeah, as you say, I was working at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence. I was working in the Bristol Robotics Laboratory. And, you know, I was a firm believer in this technological future. But there's something that seems to happen to some people that work in that area, like Bill Joy and me and a few other people. You can go two ways. You can either sort of become a complete evangelist for this technology, yeah, or you can somehow flip around and begin to really worry about it and almost hope that it doesn't go in the direction that you think it's going.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Joy, for example, you know, he was the CEO of some microsystems, a pioneer in software. He wrote this article for Wired magazine around 2000 that sort of saying, you know, what's going on? Oh, you know, I might be working to create the technology that makes humanity go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And so he quit his job. The Unabomber as well. He was a mathematician working on, you know, advanced maths that could also feed into artificial intelligence. He quit his job and became a survivalist. And I think I kind of got into the same kind of worries about the technology and began to think, well, maybe it would be better off if the whole thing just imploded and we went back to sort of a more primitive way of living.
And beyond that, we just said where you were working in the in Bristol in artificial intelligence. Beyond that, where else were you at this point? As this is going to be a story of not just the collapse of civilization, but the collapse of Dylan Evans.
Right.
Whereabouts were you at that point?
So I think, you know, at this point, I was, in some ways, I was, you know, very successful. I'd managed to, you know, written a number of books. I was working in the cutting edge of artificial intelligence. I, you know, everything seemed on the surface to be going well for me. But I think deep down, I was unhappy. I was lonely. I was beginning, I think, to go into a depression, but I didn't realize it at the time. And I think I began, instead of sort of dealing with these psychological problems that were beginning to sort of well up, I projected it all out onto the outside world and said, oh, it's, you know, the reason I'm unhappy is not because I've got issues, but because the whole industrial technological system is making me unhappy. And so maybe it's making everyone unhappy. And in order for us to sort of regain our happiness that technology is robbing us of, we've got to sort of hope that technology will collapse and we can go back to living in a sort of more natural way.
But that wasn't a, for yourself, a particularly a utopian prospect. I mean, there are a lot of people, and we'll talk about some of the people that come and live on the commune with you later on, but, you know, there are people for who that's an attractive proposition, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, there is this, because I mean, that seems odd at first, because you think, okay, civilization collapses, billions of people will die, how is that mm-hmm. possibly utopian? How is that a good thing? But there is, as you say, a sort of a movement, or a subculture that I call doomers, who really look forward to this because they see this as a sort of way of getting away from the sort of darkness of modern technology and returning to a sort of more sort of idyllic pre-industrial past. And I got fully sucked into this sort of way of thinking myself. And, you know, before too long, I was, you know, not just preparing for the collapse of civilization. I was actually desperately hoping that it would collapse so that we could all go back to sort of living a more natural and simple life.
There's one thing that speculated on this, but how did you get from the thought, writing the scenario even, to actually the point where it starts to become a reality?
So I thought, I've always been interested in the idea that sometimes in order to really learn about many things, it's not enough just to speculate about it, to think about it in the comfort of your armchair. You've got to sort of do it in some way. And so, you know, I could have, say, just written a science fiction novel about how civilization collapses and how people survive. But, you know, I think, you know, you're always limited by your imagination in that when you try and just write fiction. And sometimes you can only discover things by, as it were, trying to act it out in the real world. So that's why I came up with the experiment. Instead of just sort of imagining what it would be like, I'd try and act it out with a bunch of volunteers.
Nonetheless, this thing is, while you're going to be getting back to, you know, getting back to basics, this thing obviously is going to take quite a bit of money to set up.
Yes, well, I think I needn't have spent quite so much on it, but I think, yeah, so I actually, to fund it, I sold my house. And, you know, I sold it at the top of the market. That was 2006. And I ended up with about £100,000, which I basically wasted on the experiment. And after about a year, it's, you know, if I'd had £10,000, I might have done the experiment just as well or just as badly. But, you know, I wouldn't have. But as it, you know, when you've got more money, you just, I spent it on solar panels that ended up being completely pointless in Scotland. or buying the remains of an old signal box, which was a complete waste of time as well. We could have spent, you know, half of that and just made a log cabin, you know. So
there's something very sort of Fitzcarraldo about that sequence with the signal box, getting it from somebody's garden over to the commune.
That sort of sums up the kind of craziness of the whole experiment, I think, that and other sort of incidents like this. But I think also at the back of my mind was this idea that I wanted to be out there without a plan B. I didn't want to have a safety net. It made it more real if everything was on the line for me. I wanted to put myself in a position where, you know, there was no exit strategy. And I thought that would be a good thing. But, you know, obviously, when I realised a year into the experiment how completely in the deep end I was, it didn't seem like a good thing anymore. As my friend Angus said to me at the time, he said, you know, when I was sort of beginning to go into this really dark place, I said, what's wrong with me? He said, Dylan, you wanted to get outside your comfort zone. Now you're outside your comfort zone. You don't bloody like it.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
We'll come back to that point you just raised, because actually part of the way through the experiment, you do end up with somewhere you can bolt off to for most of the time. But we'll come back to that. So let's talk about how did you attract people to it?
Right. So when I came up with the idea for the experiment, I just put a page on my website asking for volunteers to come and join me in this experiment in post-apocalyptic living. One of the things I wanted to do was just to see what would happen, and so I didn't try and promote it. I just thought, well, you know, this was part of my sort of messianic complex at the time. I just thought, I don't have to do anything. The right people will come. Mm-hmm. If you build it, they will come, kind of thing. And so I just put this page up there and just sat back, and I was just curious to see, would anybody mm-hmm. apply at all? Would anybody even find the page? But in fact, they did, and, you know, within a few weeks, I was getting dozens of applications, and so that part was actually quite successful in the sense that I did attract hundreds and hundreds of applicants, and I was able, you know, I couldn't possibly accept them all, but it gave me a bunch of people to choose from.
And I mean, you're a published author, you had a website, you were in the press about it and stuff as well, so there was publicity about the project.
Yes, there was, but I mean, I didn't, publicity came, as it were, without me having to do anything to mm-hmm. get that. Because some people started, you know, saw the page, they shared it. Other people, you know, saw that, they shared it. Journalists then latched onto it. And that was kind of part of the fun, was seeing just would it take on a life of its own? And it did, you know, and perhaps it took on so much of a life of its own that it was very rapidly was no longer, you know, I couldn't control it anymore.
So what are the sort of the basic, tedious, logistical steps that you have to take, first of all, to start this thing off?
Well, it ends up being a lot more tedious and a lot more complicated than you think. Again, because I had this sort of very naive, rosy idea that it would just all happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to figure out where people are going to live. And, you know, part of the experiment is that people have to build the accommodation. But you can't just expect people to turn up with nothing. Mm-hmm. So you have to provide some basic infrastructure.
I mean, there would be stuff.
There would be stuff,
the post-apocalyptic world, there would be stuff to scavenge.
People could, exactly. So this is a kind of cross, as it were, between sort of scrap heap challenge and mm-hmm. survivor or something like that. So, you know, one of the first volunteers, Adam, you know, helped me build some yurts for the first volunteers. But then, you know, the planning authority saw the yurts. They said, oh, you know, you can't do this. You've got to apply for planning permission. So I had to apply for planning permission. And then someone said, oh, well, you know, someone had an accident. I thought, oh, maybe I better get some insurance, you know. So this, ironically, as I was sort of trying to escape from civilization, I actually kind of ended up getting more bogged down in all the bureaucracy that I was trying to get away from.
But also in terms of, you know, the accident, as far as you want to get away from civilization, you obviously, I mean, you know, there are still antibiotics and stuff. You can't let people die.
Well, this is it. So you end up having to make all these trade-offs, all these compromises. That's just because, as you say, you know, what's the alternative? You either, you know, so when one of the volunteers cut his hand with an axe, luckily it wasn't too serious, but, you know, we took him to a hospital. What's the alternative? Okay, we just try and let the wound cure naturally, but maybe it becomes infected, and then it maybe, you know, he loses his hand.
What happens?
Cut it off. Or something. Yeah, I mean, so you end up having to make all these compromises that is it's part of the world we live in, but it's also, it feels like cheating. Mm-hmm. And that makes you feel that, you know, the experiment is not really as authentic as it should be. And then you feel, oh, you know, why can't we just do it properly? But that's, again, you know, part of the kind of, in a sense, that's one of the interesting things mm-hmm. about doing something like this.
We haven't actually established where you did it, which obviously is sort of quite relevant to how things turn out. So how did you go about finding the location?
Right, so
didn't you do it in Cornwall?
Well, why didn't I do it in some nice warm country like Mexico or something like that? I think, you know, why did I do it in the north of Scotland, you know, one of the rainiest, coldest parts of the UK? Well, partly there was this idea that, you know, if climate change makes, you know, the whole world warm up, maybe the mm-hmm. south of England will be too warm by the time, you know, so we need to sort of go further north. But also, I had a friend in the Highlands who had some land. Her brother was a farmer, and so he leased some of the land to me. And it was actually, you know, I liked the idea of also being in this place where the weather would be challenging. Because, again, it was about making things as hard as possible for myself. I wanted it to be difficult. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be a challenge. And, you know, I ended up biting off more than I could chew. But that was, again, you know, I wanted it to be hard.
Tell us about some of the other people then, some of the people that joined. There were people that stayed there for long periods of time, people that become central to the story, but also people come up and, you know, stay for a couple of weeks or a month or something.
Right, yeah. So the idea was that I wanted to have people, you know, from a whole variety of backgrounds and ages. And so if I required everyone to be there for the whole time, you know, would have ended up with just everyone, you know, a bunch of people in their 20s. Mm-hmm. But I allowed people to come for less time, and we had a revolving door policy, so people could stay for as little as 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, when one of them left, someone else would take their place. And that meant that we got people of all ages. The oldest person who came was a retired teacher who was in her late 60s. And we had families there with young kids. But, yeah, some people became kind of core to the experiment, as you say, and they stayed for months. Probably the most significant of those was Adam, mm-hmm. who was this really colourful character who lived a fairly normal life but had sort of had some kind of breakdown, I assume, you know, in his late 40s, and was now a kind of homeless traveller. He, you know, and he was dressed in a very bizarre way. And, you know, I still have a great deal of affection for him. He was the craziest person there, apart from me, probably. You know, and he had not got on a lot of people's nerves. But something about him just sort of, I still find him very, very endearing. There was Agric, who was, again, absolutely convinced that civilization was going to collapse. He was the sort of master of our farmland and vegetable growing. So, yeah, he was also one of the key characters there. Harmony was a music student from Cambridge who played the flute and the guitar and kept us entertained with music. There was a guy called Nick who was, again, a student. You know, there were, I guess those were some of the main sort of long-term residents.
Adam, as you said, is the central figure, really, apart from yourself in this story. Also sort of personifies the idea that, you know, first of all, if this thing is going to work, everybody has got to, you know, they've got to fulfill their roles, they've got to pull together. He's a very solitary figure, isn't he?
Yeah. So Adam, yeah, one of the challenges you face, and anyone who's lived in community, whether it's a shared house at university or a commune or whatever, or even just a, you know, a family in a house is a sort of community as well. Mm-hmm. You've got to find some way of dividing up the work, and people have got to be cooperative, otherwise it's just not going to function. So, you know, you can do a rota or so, you know, and allocate tasks in various ways. And, you know, most communities, most people knuckle down and they will agree to do this. But Adam was absolutely, you know, refused to take any kind of orders from anyone else. And he only took orders from the Great Spirit. And funnily enough, the Great Spirit always seemed to agree with Adam. So he would always go off and do his own thing, which is one of the main reasons why he annoyed everybody else so much. You know, he just would not cooperate. And when you're faced with someone who like that, there's very little you can do.
Before we go into the second half, tell us some good memories of it. How did it work?
Right. So the first few months, I got up to the site in summer of 2006. And it was, you know, it was because it was summer, the days were long, it was warm. It was fantastic being outside all day long. You know, when you've worked in an office, or in my case, I was in a laboratory a lot of the time, a robotics lab, but it was still indoors. And there I was outdoors all day long in the sunshine and chopping wood, planting crops, clearing the land, putting up yurts. And it felt fantastic. You know, I was healthy, I was fit, I was enjoying myself. And, you know, I still look back on those moments with a lot of affection and fondness. And that was, and then, you know, in the evening, cooking over an open fire, sitting round, having conversations, telling stories. That was great.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Dylan Evans, and we're talking about his book, The Utopia Experiment. And Dylan, in this half then, we're gonna get into where it all went wrong. And, well, to begin with, something I hinted at in the first half is that part of the way through this experiment, you get involved with somebody, get into a relationship, and this means that you can spend a lot of time not on site, which I think is sort of one of the significant points where you sort of take your eye off the ball a bit.
Absolutely, yeah. So when I started the experiment, I was single, and I'd always sort of seen that as, you know, I was going to do this as a single person, and my focus would be completely on the experiment. But I started going out with someone just before I went up to Scotland, and ended up getting very involved, falling in love with her, and then persuading her to come and join me up in Scotland. And everyone I was, you know, who was involved said that, Dylan, this is a bad idea. You know, that's going to, you're going to have divided attention. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely right, you know. So I naively thought, oh, well, she'll come and live on the experiment with us. But she had a kid. That didn't really appeal to her, living in a yurt with a young kid. So I rented a cottage for her about a mile or two away from the experiment. And then I was really split between the two, because I obviously, you know, wanted to see her, and I didn't want her to move up to Scotland and then suddenly, you know, never see her. So I would go to see her and spend a few nights a week with her at the cottage. And then I'd feel guilty because I wasn't at the experiment. And I'd go back to the experiment the next day, and then I'd feel guilty because I wasn't with her. And, you know, this. But I think, you know, maybe, you know, maybe that was symptomatic of something that I wanted. Maybe I wanted some kind of bolt hole. Maybe, you know, I was already, you know, in a sense, feeling not fully committed to it, to, you know, and that's, maybe it was a sort of chicken and egg thing, I don't know. But for whatever reason, yeah, this just ended up sort of leading to a kind of schizophrenic existence, where I was sort of really, you know, I'd created two little communities, and I wasn't fully a member of either.
And so before we broke, you mentioned the, you know, the nice things about camping out in the summer in Scotland. Let's talk about the reality of living in a yurt through a Scottish winter.
Right, yes. So it's one thing to live in a yurt in the summertime when it's nice and dry and warm. But, you know, as the experiment wound on, we went into autumn and then winter. And, you know, I thought, well, yurts will still be good for the winter because we have, you know, they have a stove in the middle. That's why the Mongolian nomads can live in them and survive through the Mongolian winter, which is, you know, even colder than Scotland. But, you know, Scotland isn't just cold. It's also very wet. And the yurts are well suited for the Mongolian winter, which is very cold and dry, but not so well suited to the Scottish winter, which is very cold and wet. And so, you know, often I'd wake up, I'd go to sleep very toasty at night. You know, we'd bank up the stove with, you know, so it was really warm inside the yurt. But then also, unlike the Mongolians, the task of a Mongolian woman or wife is to keep the stove burning 24 hours a day, and woe betide her if she doesn't. Unfortunately, we didn't have any Mongolian wives up there to keep the stove burning through the night. So we'd drift off very warm, but then, you know, the stove would go out, we'd wake up, I'd wake up 3 a.m, freezing cold, maybe the wind would have fumbled open some of the canvas, there'd be a rain dripping in, and I'd be like, why on earth did I build yurts?
And at this point as well, obviously the financial situation is getting worse all the time. You're spending more and throwing more and more money into it. There must become a point where, first of all, you're realising how much you're spending, but also realising that you're in too deep, really. You may as well carry on.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing, after, you know, all 9-10 months into the experiment, yeah, the money is all, is, even though, you know, as I said, I had about £100,000 to start with. I don't know how I managed to spend all that so quickly. But, you know, one of the things that if you read the history of communities and communes and the economics of these things is the sort of hidden but vital, you know, underbelly of all of these things, that many, many of these experiments have failed in the past because of the simple thing of just running out of money. And, you know, then I began to sort of think for the first time, what am I going to do next? And I don't know why. I just never even... When I guess I was so carried away with setting up the experiment to begin with, I hadn't even sort of thought that far ahead. Or maybe deep down, I really did think that civilization was going to collapse and I didn't need to have any money because the whole financial system would collapse. And then by then we'd be self-sufficient and I'd be kind of well set up because money wouldn't be valuable even if I had it then. So, but yeah, as the time went on and civilization didn't look like it was going to collapse immediately, and I didn't have any money left, I was thinking, oh my God, what have I done?
And of course, this wouldn't necessarily have been apparent to you at the time, but with hindsight, at what point does your depression and the sort of falling apart of the community become sort of the same thing, basically entwined?
Well, it was very abrupt, really, I think. You know, as I say, when I went up to Scotland in summer 2006, I was sort of on a roll. I was sort of almost manic, you know. I was carried away by this massive energy, and that fueled me for, you know, 9 or 10 months. But then suddenly that energy ran out. It was a combination of things. Obviously, I got to the end of the end, but I wasn't eating properly. You know, it's hard to keep all, you know, eat properly when you're just sort of feeding yourself and from what you can grow. And literally, you know, it was from almost one day to the next, or certainly 1 week to the next, I went from being this sort of, you know, absolutely, you know, sort of manic founder of this community to sort of waking up in the dead of night, shivering and flooded with anxiety and terrified about what was going to come next and what the hell had I done with my life. And I began to go into a really dark place. I don't think the community really fell apart. I think it was just me. I think most of the, if not all the other volunteers, were still having a great time. You know, but they, you know, they all had homes to go back to. I didn't. You know, I was all in. And so but there was this sort of very curious sort of thing that they were faced with, was the founder of the community, the one who set it up, doesn't really believe in it anymore. And is sort of that sort of, you know, they're thinking, what's gone wrong with the guy? He's sort of suddenly he's turned into a ghost.
And I mean, again, looking back on that with hindsight, you were, you know, the founder sounds like quite a benign thing, but in some ways you're a bit cult leader-y in a bit. You know, you got people to come to this thing. You mean, you quite happily admit in the book that you always saw them as lab rats, as people to literally conduct an experiment on. It's called the Utopia Experiment. It was an experiment.
Right, yeah. And I was, you know, I think if I'd been a bit better at being a cult leader, maybe it wouldn't have gone so badly. You know, the problem was that I kind of really realised that I wasn't actually a very good cult leader. The point of being a cult leader is that you have to have this unshakable belief in yourself. And I did for the first 9 or 10 months. But then I lost that belief in myself. So, you know, in addition to falling apart myself, I felt there was this extra guilt of thinking, I've got all these people up here to follow me and join this community that I founded, and they expect me to be a, you know, charismatic leader, or I thought they expected me to be, and suddenly I wasn't. Suddenly I was a pathetic, miserable idiot. And I felt, you know, that I'd completely let them down, and suddenly they were all stranded up there, and the guy who sort of got them all to come up there is a gibbering mess.
But surely that's a good thing to learn about yourself, right? That you don't have the makings of a charismatic cult leader.
I think it is on balance, it's better to be the kind of person that isn't a cult leader. But it was a great disappointment to me at the time. You know, I did sort of, I guess, you know, in the back of my mind, I think I did actually want to be some kind of guru, some, you know, that, and they would be my followers. They would be, You know, and I it was a great disappointment to find that actually I didn't have what it takes to be a cult leader. As you say, it's probably a better thing, you know, in the long run. But at the time, I felt, oh dear.
I'm Emma Jane Unsworth. Go and read some great new journalism and explore the interview archive at littleatoms.com.
During the months you were up there, you went to visit some other similar communities and ones that were successful.
Yeah.
So why do some work and some don't?
Ah, that's a good question. I think, they probably have more of a plan. especially some kind of financial plan, mm-hmm. in terms of how they're going to get an income and sustain the whole thing economically. They probably have taken more time to acquire the necessary skills, and they are more aware of maybe how difficult it is, and they haven't sort of got this, you know, I was just arrogant, you know, I was cocksure. I thought I could go anywhere, do anything, and I'd do it better than everyone else. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I learned, and it was quite humbling, was that it's much more difficult than that. And, you know, I take my hat off to all the people who've running communities and have made them last for years, because it is a very hard thing to do. And, you know, I learned my lesson.
And, I mean, a lot of these communities, not the ones that you actually do talk about going and visiting, a lot of these cyber communities that do last, and that last for a long time, tend to be probably religious. You know, they're built around, there's a more compelling central idea to them, as well as just being self-sufficient.
Absolutely, yes. I think this is actually one of the key secrets to success for many communities, is to have some religious or spiritual kind of belief
system. Or a charismatic
system.
Cult leader.
Yeah, or both. Yeah. You know, I mean, Findhorn, for example, works partly because they do have this belief in the spiritual purpose for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm an atheist, and I was very clear from the beginning that this was not going to be a religious experiment. And, you know, it may be that was actually, you know, I hate to admit it, but it might, you know, because I am still an atheist, but, you know, it may be that atheists are not very good at building communities, because, you know, we kind of almost do need a kind of irrational belief in something higher than ourselves in order to get people to kind of pull together through the most difficult times.
You should have listened to the Great Spirit.
I should have done. Well, Adam was obviously, you know, better cut out for that than I was. But the other thing is, everyone else has to believe in it as well. And he wasn't very good at persuading.
It's no good if only one of you believes in
it.
No. So we haven't mentioned this. I mean, this all took place roughly a decade ago, didn't it? What happened to the other members of the community? I know you haven't seen many of them, but, I mean, have you seen anyone?
Yeah, so, as we were saying, as we started off the conversation, you know, I ended up being sectioned and going, you know, being, you know, detained for my own safety and sent to a mental hospital for a month. And when I, while I was in the hospital, it was actually the sanest place I'd been for about a year, to be honest. When I was in the hospital, I thought, right, well, you know, I really have touched rock bottom now. When I get out, I'm going to go back to the experiment and tell everyone that it's over and it's time to go home. And I thought, you know, naively, that they would all, you know, agree and they would all go home. There might be a few tears shed, but they would all accept that. But, you know, I'd completely failed to foresee the possibility that, you know, which is what actually happened. I went back, I got out of hospital, went back to the Utopia experiment, told them that it was all over and it was time to go. And they just said, no, we're not going. We like it here. So, you know, I was kind of a bit flummoxed by that, and I just didn't know what to do. Eventually, after a few weeks, I said, well, look, I can't make you guys go, so I'm going. So I said, in a sense, you know, I realised it wasn't my experiment anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it was their experiment now, and that kind of made it easier for me to leave, because if it was still my baby, I couldn't have maybe abandoned it. But now I realized it wasn't my baby anymore, it was really theirs, so that made it kind of slightly easier for me to leave. And some of them are still there, you know, I don't think there's anyone who lives full-time permanently on the site anymore, but a number of people live in the vicinity and regularly go there, spend, you know, a few hours a day cultivating a vegetable garden. Some people have, you know, gone back to their regular houses and jobs in other parts of the country, but they go back to the site for a few weeks or months each year. And so it does have a kind of life of its own. And they renamed it the Phoenix Experiment because it had sort of risen from the ashes of the Utopia Experiment. And, you know, that's good. So in a sense, well, you know, it created something good for other people, even if it wasn't such a great experience for me.
And you decided to write a book about it, so that must have been a, you know, an interesting experience, trawling up those memories.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wanted to write about it, you know, from the beginning, but when I left the Scotland and came back down to England, you know, I tried to start writing about it, but I couldn't, you know, each time I tried, it was just too painful. And when I did write about it, I wasn't really totally honest with myself because I tried to put a positive spin on it. I was too ashamed to tell what had actually happened because it was such a major failure on my part. I felt like I was, you know, I'd gone off with this big fanfare telling everyone, look, I'm going to create this utopia, and it had all come crashing down. So it wasn't until, you know, a couple of years ago that I finally kind of thought, well, look, I'm ready to write about this now. And writing about it was very cathartic. It did sort of help me to, in a sense, reach some kind of closure about it and process what had happened. And I think that was actually a vital part of the whole experience, was actually writing about it and telling the story.
And so where is Dylan Evans now? So I mentioned that you live in Guatemala. So
right.
That's one thing, but how are you?
So I feel, you know, very happy and sort of, I think writing the book actually, you know, helped me to put most of the ghosts to rest. I wouldn't say all of them. I'm still got haunted by a few demons. Probably a good thing. You know, I don't think you can write if you have no demons at all. But I think it's helped me to, get to a place where I'm a lot more sort of accepting of myself and all the, you know, the bad and the good. And so I now live in Guatemala and in a sense, I'm living on a ranch in the highlands in Guatemala, which is kind of weirdly like what I was doing in the Utopia Experiment. So it wasn't planned like that, but I have ended up almost doing a kind of Utopia 2.0. But the two big differences is, one, it's hot. And two, it's just me on my own there. So I think those make all the difference to me and mean that I'm a lot happier now.
That's a good point for us to finish. So I've been talking to Dylan Evans, and we've been talking about his book, The Utopia Experiment, which is out now, currently in hardback from Picador, but it's out in paperback in September. So, Dylan, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Christopher Bolan. Check out the growing Little Adams media empire at littleadams.com.
Andrew Muller is a contributing editor at Monocle and broadcasts regularly on its radio arm, Monocle 24. He also writes for The Guardian, Uncut, New Humanist and Bluffers, among other titles, and has reported for more than 80 countries. He's previously the author of Rock and Hard Places and I Wouldn't Start From Here, which we've discussed on a previous Little Atoms, and he was partially responsible, in cahoots with Luke Haynes and Cathal Coughlan, for the acclaimed 2012 music historiography The North Sea Scrolls. His country band, The Blazing Zoos, will release their second album in 2015, and his latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is a memoir. It's Too Late to Die Young Now, Misadventures in Rock and Roll. So Andrew, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
This is a memoir of your life as a rock journalist. And I say that very insistently. We've talked in the past about your other proper journalism, I say pointedly.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to call it proper journalism, but thank you for the adjective.
But you still claim that the sobriquet rock journalist quite proudly, don't you?
I do. It's what I started out doing professionally, and it's what I first. It was my first real stirring of wanting to be anything other than the standard things of wanting to bat number five for Australia, play centre half forward for Geelong, or fly fighter planes for the Australian Air Force. I started reading Melody Maker, the British rock paper in the late 80s and decided that that was what I wanted to do. But before that, I had already started writing more or less by accident for the street press in Sydney. So, yeah, the book is, it's mostly a chronicle of ages about 18 to about 28, which for me would have been late 80s to mid 90s.
Well, let's talk about before 18, first of all. So, early years in Australia. How did you first get into music, Andrew?
Late, actually. Properly into music quite late on. I went to a lot of different schools because my father was a soldier, and at most of them I don't recall music being a massively big deal. I maybe wasn't in any one place long enough to become attuned to what the particular subcultures were. I think, like most teenagers in the early to mid-80s, I think I quite liked Midnight Oil and Australian rock music of that sort. But
this is most Australian teenagers.
Most Australian teenagers, yes. But in the my last school, I went to Mossman High School in Sydney, an absolutely excellent state high school, which just happened to be the one up the road from the base we were living on, did have a kind of culture in which alternative music was discussed and traded and swapped around and very much enjoyed it. And around the same time, I became aware of the Sydney radio station Triple J FM, which was a branch of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, state broadcaster. I guess it performed a role not dissimilar to what Radio 6 does now in Britain. So, between Triple J and my school friends, then, yeah, that kind of opened music up to me. And though I know, and I admit in the book, that everybody thinks that the part of their life when they first properly got into music was the absolute golden age against which all others must be measured, that much admitted, there was definitely something going on in Australian alternative circles in the late 80s. You could see a genuinely great act playing at the pub up the street most weeks. You could go to the Mossman Hotel, a 20-minute walk from my house on a Friday night, and see Ed Cooper or the Go-Betweens or the Triffords or Paul Kelly or any one of dozens of others, all of which I still think would stand comparison.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Anybody anywhere.
And how much of that was a sort of function of you being so far away as well, without wanting to make it sound like, you know, this was the Victorian times and the foreign press turned up on a T-clipper every 3 months or something. It was a lot more difficult to get stuff.
Oh, the foreign press almost literally did turn up on a T-clipper 3 months late. When I bought Melody Maker by accident for the first time during my lunch break when I was working at a record shop in Crow's Nest in Sydney. And it was a three-month-old copy. It had Gay Bikers on Acid on the cover. This would have been in 1988, I think. So, yeah, you basically, if you wanted to read the British music press, you had two options. You could buy them 3 months old when they arrived off the ship. Or there were a couple of shops in Sydney which did get air freight copies, which arrived in Sydney about a week after publication in London, but which were ruinously expensive. But then, you know, so was buying imported records.
Yeah.
Absolute madness. But it did end up in this bizarre circumstance in which if once you started getting the air freighted music magazines, you could literally spend 3 months imagining what this band you'd been reading about would sound like before you finally got your hands on their actual recorded output. Extraordinary.
So tell us more about the Australian scene then. So when you first... Well, no, before we get onto that, let's talk about how you first started writing.
It was mostly... I'd started being interested in the idea of writing at that last school, at Mossman High School, which was an exceptionally encouraging environment. It was just a genuinely great school, a massive stroke of luck to get planted there. And I'd always enjoyed writing things and writing about things. I was one of those peculiar students who used to enjoy writing essays, and I'd always read a lot. We'd always had a house full of books. But it was at that school where, you know, teachers did start to say things like, you know, you could... this is something you could think about pursuing once you leave these halls. So there was that. And the thing that really started off was I had started reading a newspaper called On the Street, which was a free weekly magazine which mostly listed gigs in and around Sydney, but which also carried reviews and features. And I suspect I may have been at home fulminating about what seemed to me a certain lack of editorial standards. And my mother, who was always a very practically minded, can-do person, said, well, if you think you can do any better, why not give it a crack? So I did. Maternal goading was basically what started me off.
And you took in the book about the first time you saw your work in print in On the Street.
Yeah. I think for anybody who ends up writing for a living, and anybody who arrived at that point having been in love with the idea of writing for a living, the first time you see your name in print, it's no small change. I remember the moment with somewhat embarrassing clarity, which is why I do talk about it, I think, at some length in the book. But I think everybody who's ever written knows that feeling. That said, in the modern environment where basically anybody with a telephone can sort of, you know, publish in inverted commas something and sort of announce their case to the world, the edge may have come off it a little bit. But yeah, that feeling, and there's two particular examples I remember, both of which I mentioned in the book. Seeing my name in On the Street for the first time, which was a review of Ed Cooper and The Yard Goes On Forever at the Mossman Hotel, and seeing my name in Melody Maker for the first time. Both events which happened about a block apart in the same part of downtown Sydney, and both of which still rank, possibly rather tragically, as two of the biggest and most intense compressed thrills I think I've ever had.
Okay, so let's, as I said, I want to talk about that Australian music scene at that time, but sort of through the prism of you starting to write about music, going to those gigs and reviewing them.
Yeah, it was it's weirder in retrospect because, as I do also, I think, admit quite freely in the book, I had absolutely no idea what I was doing at all. I was 18 when I started writing about music, which in some respect is a good age to start writing about music, because obviously you're incredibly engaged with it. It's the stuff of life itself. The downside is that at 18, you're probably not going to be terrifically good at the actual writing and reporting, which I wasn't at all. This is, as anybody who remembers any of it will be happy to agree, this is not false modesty on my part. The hardest thing about writing this book was having to go through all the scrapbooks and get confronted with this appalling drivel that I wrote for years. It takes a long time to get any good at writing. It took me a long time anyway. So there was that, but I was obviously blissfully unaware of this at the time.
Well, and also, in those days, you're the only person that has that scrapbook, right? I mean, you clearly don't have that passion nowadays.
No, you don't. And I do definitely say this in the book, that I cannot overstate my gratitude for the non-existence of the internet at that point, because I've seen it happen a few times in the last few years where some poor kid's written something, you know, ill-advised or ill-thought, or just the kind of thing you write when you're young, and got completely monstered for it online. And yeah, every single time that happens, I participated possibly once or twice, but nonetheless, there's always that feeling of like, oh my god, there, but for the grace of, and it would be crushing. It would be, you know, even at a point at which I'm 46 years old and I've been doing this my entire adult life, you still don't like sort of people telling you you're an idiot and you're no good at what you're doing. But by the time, hopefully, you're 46 years old and you've been doing something your entire life, you acquire a certainly, or a reasonably thick skin and the requisite confidence to sort of wave it off. But yeah, that would have been absolutely crushing. Although, again, this is a bit of a circular argument. You could end up saying that given the absolute absence of quality in everything I was writing, I deserved to be crushed. But nonetheless, it was what it was, and I was in the position I was in. And that obviously meant I could go and see a lot of bands for free. It meant I got a lot of records for free, which, again, at the time was a pretty big deal. And it meant I was able to sort of begin the always... Well, it gave me the ability to embark on the always weird thing of actually, you know, meeting one's heroes, which is a strange thing to do. At least it's a strange thing to do as long as you insist on regarding them as heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Once you stop doing that, then it's not a strange thing to do at all. But yeah, at the time it was really, really weird. You end up being, you know, again, it seems retrospectively incredible that these things were allowed to happen. But yes, like, you know, you're 19 years old, go and interview Elvis Costello. And, you know, but that sort of thing used to happen on a more or less weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Caitlin Doty. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This happens after you already start writing for the Melody Maker from Australia, which we'll get onto in a bit. But I wanted to talk about how you sort of learn to write. And there's a period of time before you come to England where you work for a tabloid.
That particular incident has really nothing to do with being a rock journalist. But I was determined to put it in because it's a magazine called The Picture. It may still exist, I don't know. It is inexcusable, frankly. It was a weekly supermarket tabloid, possibly most analogous in this country to something like the Daily Sport in its heyday. Consisted largely pictures of not overclad young women, and the spaces between those were filled up with news stories, which, frankly, we just made up. And it was so much fun. It really, really was. It was just... I worked there for 3 months and I was in tears of laughter for almost all of it. It was just the most immense hoot. The other writers on the features desk at The Picture went on to enjoy extremely distinguished careers as proper journalists. Winners of the Walkley Award, the Australian equivalent of the Pulitzer, some very proper people worked at The Picture. It was such good fun. But I will say, I do think working on a tabloid early on is a great thing for any writer to do because it does discipline you a lot. It teaches you a lot about structure, about how to, where the beginning, middle and end of the story are. And that's really important. It knocks a lot of the bullshit out of your writing really, really quickly, which is good because, I mean, obviously when you're working for other people later, you can spoon all the bullshit back in. But it's very, very good to have that process of just having what you've done taken apart and put back together. And even though what you're writing or what I was writing at the time was ridiculous because it was all entirely invented and almost always in absolutely dubious taste, the mechanics of that, of how to communicate this obviously risible story, were incredibly useful. It really drilled into me the idea of beginning, middle, end. What's your actual point here? Where are we going with this?
So you become a Sydney correspondent for the Melody Maker, first of all. So tell me how that came about.
It came about through a combination really of persistence and blind luck. I'd started reading Melody Maker, and when I say reading it, I'd become mildly obsessed with it and decided that this was, you know, what I wanted to do. So I sent them a few reviews of bands that had played in Sydney that I thought they might be interested in. And when I say sent, and for the amusement of your younger listeners, I will say I had typed up these reviews on a typewriter and folded the paper into an envelope and posted it to Melody Maker. I mean, yeah, extraordinary. The first of these arrived on the watch of then reviews editor Paul Mather, who ignored all of them, I suspect quite rightly. I noticed because I read everything in Melody Maker that the reviews editor had changed. Paul Mather had left the job and been replaced by someone or something called Everett True. So I thought, well, you know, I'll give it another crack. So I sent in a review of a band from New Zealand called Straightjacket Fits, who I'd seen play at the Lansdowne Hotel, not far from where I was living at the time in Sydney. I thought, you know, they were quite well regarded. They were on Flying Nun, the sort of very well-known New Zealand indie label, which had a bit of a cult following in Britain, etc., etc., etc. So I sent this review off into wherever these things get sent to. The two things I didn't know were, one, that Everett True was absolutely obsessed with Flying Nun Records. I did not know this. I also did not know that in the interregnum between me writing this review and sending it, he had written the singles for Melody Maker, reviewed the that week's singles and made Straitjacket fit single of the week. And I rather suspect, as a consequence, had been subject to a measure of mockery from his colleagues about, you know, Everett, who are these people? You know, you made them up, haven't you? They do. I mean, come on. So by way of shoring up his position, this unsolicited review arrives from the colonies agreeing that Straitjacket fits are a very fine thing indeed. And so I think basically in order to shore up his own position, he wanged it into the paper. And that was the beginning of my association with Melody Maker. I didn't hear anything from them. I sent a few more things in, which they printed. And then one day, yeah, Everett rang me up at my house in Sydney and said, you know, this is fine, keep it coming. And by the way, we do have every intention of paying you for this. How do we actually do that? And that was how it began. Persistence and an immense stroke of fortune. I mean, really, bless ET, but it can still happen. You can wake screaming in the night at 4 o'clock in the morning, thinking that you're basically your entire and very, very blessed adult existence has hinged on a whim had one afternoon by Everett True at his desk in Kingsreach Tower in 1989. Yeah. I've no idea which other way that particular fork in the road goes, mm-hmm. but I suspect it would have been a lot less fun.
How does that work then? So you're over in Australia and you're writing for Melody Maker, you're reviewing stuff that's obviously going on locally, not just Australian scene, but international bands that are obviously coming yeah. through Australia and playing. But like, you're still living at home at this point.
By the time I was working for Melody Maker, I think I wasn't living at home anymore. It was around about that time. But there was a period where I was interviewing international artists for On the Street, mostly on the phone, where I was living at home.
Yeah, this is what I wanted to get to. So when your mother was taking answer phone messages for you.
Yeah, well again, this does seem an awful lot longer ago than 1988. We didn't own an answering machine. Obviously, setting up telephone interviews was fraught with miscommunications, and because it wasn't like you could send somebody an email. Mm-hmm. You had to ring somebody in Los Angeles and leave a message, or London. And so people would phone at all hours having got something wrong. So, you know, you would end up in positions where, like, yeah, your dad gets woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning by Patricia Morrison from the Sisters of Mercy, or, as I mentioned in the book, your mother ends up striking up quite a rapport with Dwight Yoakam because we never quite get the time right and I'm not there. It was in retrospect extremely strange that you would come home from, you know, having been out and find that your mum's list of, you know, left a list of people who called while you were at a barbecue or whatever, and among, you know, sort of two or three of your friends, like, you know, Jam Master Jay from Run DMC, we'll call back later. You can get used to pretty much anything.
When was the decision made to actually come over to London?
The decision was made pretty much for me, really. My then girlfriend was very keen on going travelling, and I didn't have anything against that idea. So I decided I'd go along with that, but obviously with the idea that I had, hopefully, a foot in the door at Melody Maker, and that they weren't just interested in me because of my position in Sydney. And so I thought, well, yeah, okay, let's do that and give it a try and see how far we get.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Leo Denny. Today I'm talking to Andrew Muller, and we're talking about his memoir, It's Too Late to Die Young Now. And so, Andrew, we left you at the end of the first half, just arrived in London. So tell us about your first steps into the Melody Maker's offices.
Embarrassing to relate, I think they may literally have been on the first day I arrived in London. You know, none of this Tower of London or Buckingham Palace or Westminster Abbey. No, I went to Melody Maker pretty much as soon as the jet lag would permit me. Absolutely overawed. But for all that, you know, for all that media environments can be not necessarily the most hospitable of places, yeah, everybody just couldn't have been nicer, really. There were, you know, the sort of expected amount of jibes about my convict ancestry and so forth, but that's fine. And Yeah, just from the off, I felt pretty much instantly at home. It was, again, it's the book does mention this. It is something that I think many, if not most, magazines and newspapers now miss, because it's perfectly possible to file, copy and receive assignments without ever actually interacting with people at all. Whereas pre-internet, the only way you could actually engage at all or make a living from a magazine was to go down there. And so there were always people there, which does foster a real esprit de corps slash gang culture, which Melody Maker certainly had, and which was reflected in its pages.
And also, everyone would turn up when there wasn't actually work to do.
And people would turn up when there wasn't work to do, because we were basically the kind of people who didn't really have anything much else to do with our days. It was, as I still think journalism should be, a refuge for the otherwise unemployable. And I certainly don't exclude myself from that description. It was terrific fun. A cast of characters that you cannot imagine having been paid to do anything else by anybody else, other than perhaps to go away. But it worked, and I think that is that was the reason for the success the magazine still enjoyed, was that once that gang mentality was communicated to the pages in a way that you still see, I think, in successful titles like Private Eye or Viz, that it's understood that, you know, for any new reader, for the first six issues, they're not going to understand the half of what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I started reading Private Eye, and you think, why is everything continued on page 94? Why is discussing Uganda funny? But once you start to get attuned to the jokes, you're part of the club, and you don't want to miss anything, obviously. And I think that was the music press had an obvious advantage in fostering that kind of camaraderie among staff and readers alike.
And again, that would be something that you just wouldn't, I mean, especially on the internet, really, you just wouldn't have the time or the, you know, the space to foster that sort of commitment from the readers.
No, and there was also something different about the fact that it wasn't always on. There was just once a week, there it is.
Yeah.
This is the fruit of our deliberations. Here's 64 or 72 pages of whatever it is we've come up with. Take this away. Think about what you've learned. We'll be with you again next Tuesday. I think that's I think it's very, very little getting that back, but it's a definitely a different sort of engagement. The difference of engagement between that and an online publication is easily the same as the difference in intensity of engagement you have between limitless universe of music that comes straight out of your laptop for nothing and records that you actually had to save up for, go to a shop, buy, take home and look after.
We'll come back to that. Obviously, with hindsight as well, you arrive at the Melody Maker really at the last sort of golden age of weekly music journalism.
It turned out to be a last and quite voluble hurrah. I mean, by 1990, the Melody Maker, NME and Sounds, which still existed, were not selling anything like what they had at their mid to late 70s peaks, when they were selling hundreds of thousands of copies a week. I mean, extraordinary numbers in retrospect. But I think I'm right in saying around 1990, I think the NME was still doing a solid 100,000-ish, I think. And I think Melody Maker in a good week was doing 65 to 70-ish. I could be wrong about those. But, you know, certainly by today's standards, not too shabby. But, yeah, 1990 was the beginning of a decade in which you saw, in very rapid succession, grunge happen in a Melody. Well, 1990, Manchester's still a huge, huge thing. Stone Roses, Happy Mondays, Charlatans, etc., etc. Followed fairly swiftly after that by grunge, which Melody Maker, in the shape of Everett True, was really the first to latch onto. Melody Maker was the first magazine in the world to put Mudhoney, Nirvana, Soundgarden on the cover. And then that was obviously followed, if not indeed answered, by Britpop. And this was the last time as well at which I think there was a significant generation gap, at which we, by which I mean the alternative music press, had all of this pretty much to ourselves before everybody else noticed it. I mean, I can still remember, and I mention in the book, being at home one night watching the news when a very confused-looking BBC newsreader was sort of trying to understand why he was being asked to read out reports from Seattle of a body being found at the house of somebody called Kurt Cobain. And just in the few days after that, the broadsheet newspapers missing it completely, just didn't get it, did not understand that something actually fairly important had happened. And the early days of Britpop was a bit like that, but then largely due to the, I think once the tabloid press and broadsheet press as well, and in fact all the media realised that the Oasis versus Blur circus was just a great, great story, then it all did get rather taken away from us. But nonetheless, we were still at the centre of it, and we still did have a certain claim on it, because mostly the musicians would rather talk to us than the tabloids, for fairly obvious reasons. And so we did definitely have a ringside seat for that.
And so what was that world like? What was it like to work in that office with those people?
It was enormously good fun, mostly. It was a period at which you could make some sort of living by being a music journalist. You weren't going to get rich, but it was doable, and living in London in the mid-90s was a much more affordable proposition than obviously living in London is 20 years later. So it was you can make a reasonable living, but it was the last period in which record companies were making lots of money, and with the insane hubris that usually attends people making lots of money and doing really well, no one thinks the good times are going to end.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, there was always money to fly journalists around the world to write tour stories about bands, and when you did that, you'd get to stay in really nice hotels, and all the bills were paid, and yeah, it was enormously good fun. I mean, in retrospect, just idiotic beyond comprehension. The things that used to go on, people getting flown to New York and back in, you know, in one evening to write a 300-word review of some, you know, hopeless group playing at CBGB's, or in a more grotesque case mentioned in the book, the chartering of an entire aeroplane to take a bunch of journalists to Morocco to watch Def Leppard play in a cave,
mm-hmm.
for some reason. And that sort of thing used to go on an awful lot. And it was, you know, enormously good fun. And then it was strange and quite melancholy going back through the back issues to put the book together. And around 1996, 97, you notice Melody Maker starts to run these slightly confused-sounding stories about something called the Internet and what that's going to mean for music. And a line I'm sure appears in the book somewhere. In retrospect, it seems a bit like the dinosaurs failing to notice that star in the sky was getting bigger and brighter every day.
Well, I mean, there's two obvious things that change. I'm sure there's more, but the writing, obviously journalism changes because of the internet, but obviously music, not just consumption, but, you know, just the availability of it changes as well. So, yeah, let's talk about the time when when the internet did start to come in and change things.
Well, I'm a very, very late adopter in most technologies. I didn't own a mobile phone until about 2006. I don't think I actually sent an email until about 2000. It takes me a while. I'm a bit behind on these things. I can see that it's changed my own relationship and how I listen to music. So I don't know if it's different for people who've never known anything else. But because when I wrote for On the Street in Sydney, especially, I used to get sent a lot of free records. When I say a lot, I mean there was a point at which I was a 20-year-old who maybe owned, I don't know, 100 albums. And that obviously, you know, this was considered a thing.
Mm-hmm.
This was considered, you know, quite extraordinary. It's like, God, imagine that. That's like nearly 100 albums. How many songs? That's like nearly 1,000, you know, 1,000 different songs you have to choose from at any one time. Amazing. And it has changed, definitely. When something's just there, you don't have to do that thing of looking through record shops for weeks trying to find something. It's obviously infinitely more convenient,
mm-hmm.
infinitely more convenient, obviously much cheaper. And again, it now just seems ridiculous that it was considered reasonable to spend, you know, an actually measurable proportion of your weekly wage on, you know, 10 songs. Amazing. But, you know, I notice that now there's just all this stuff. You listen to a song and you think, yeah, that's nice. You never listen to it again. Whereas before, if you only had, even at the outside, a few dozen albums, mm-hmm. you'd listen to those records dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And I do wonder now whether people 2-3 generations of music fan behind me will ever form attachments that intense to particular records and particular songs. That may or may not be a good thing, but it's certainly a thing, because there just isn't the time. I mean, I was thinking about this just earlier today, updating my iTunes library on my iPod. There's nearly 20,000 songs on there, and they're presumably 20,000 songs I really like,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I'm 46 years old. There's already songs on that iPod I will never live long enough to listen to again. And some of those are songs I really, really like,
mm-hmm.
and I'll never hear them again. There isn't time. So I do think that must change people's relationship with music. You would be much better off putting this question to somebody at least 20 years younger than me, but I do wonder, because there's always the temptation of the other thing. It's like, you know, back when you could afford to buy one album a week, mm-hmm. if you were incredibly lucky, it's just like, right, I've got a new record, I am going to listen to the shit out of this. And you would. Even if you had, as I was many times, sort of persuaded by some gushing Melody Maker cover story to go out and spend enormous amounts of money on an imported album, on unwrapping, placing on my turntable, applying needle to plastic, turned out to be absolutely awful. But then you would then go, no, this has cost a lot of money, I'll find something in this, I will. So you sit there listening to, you know, Skinny Puppy or Front 242 or whatever, eight times in a row. I mean, no slight upon Skinny Puppy or Front 242, it's just not for me. But you would just sit there and go, no, it can't be, it must be good. Melody Maker wouldn't have put it on the cover otherwise. But yeah, there wasn't a choice. I mean, what else are you going to be doing? There isn't this other limitless universe you can just think, well, I'll dispose of that and try something else instead. I may be wrong about this. People's brains may have been recalibrated so you can now form attachments that intense by a fleeting encounter with something on Spotify. I rather doubt it, but I don't know. But I do find myself, you know, you sit there with your iPod flicking from song to song, and there's a great line in Retromania by my former Melody Maker colleague Simon Reynolds, mm-hmm. who he says he does wonder how far you are from the point at which it will become normal to just sit, you know, on a train or a bus with your iPod without even any headphones, mm-hmm. and just, you know, flicking and just enjoying the kind of rush of emotions and associations you get from just seeing the title. There are probably already people doing this, I suspect.
I'm Selena Godden. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
And the other thing, you know, I was exactly the sort of person that was consuming the magazine, the Melody Maker and the Enemy when you were writing for them.
Well, thank you.
And would, you know, go out and buy some terrible, you know, Cart of the Unstoppable Sex Machine rubbish or something, because I was told to by the Enemy, or the, well, it would have been the Enemy.
It would
not
have
the
certainly
Maker.
Been the Enemy telling you to buy cars.
And what's happened to that? I mean, there are obviously websites, and it's not true to say that people do not get attached to artists now. And in fact, in some respects, they get. Not long after this website started, we posted an article basically having a go at Ed Sheeran and singer-songwriters, and are still getting tweets about it. Every other day, well, somebody sees that, and are really upset by it. Like,
but that's a different kind of engagement. I think that's what's fostered by social media in particular. That's engagement with, it's engagement with the artist, not the art. In that pre-internet, etc. Say there was a band you really liked. Like, who was a band I really liked in 1990? Say a band I really liked. The Cure. I really liked The Cure. I liked The Cure. But, so if I saw an interview with Robert Smith in a music magazine, I might buy that music magazine, I would take it home, I would read that interview. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much all I hear from Robert Smith, or about Robert Smith, until next time he gives an interview to a magazine that I read. Whereas now, what I would then do is obviously you go away and you listen to your Cure records. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, if you want to be engaged with the artist's life, you can do that as a full-time job. You know, you can do nothing else all day but, if the artist is big enough, but read about them, look at videos of them, argue with other people about them. And I think in the midst of all that, I'm not really sure how much attention is actually getting paid to the music, including by some of the artists.
You've taken the classic music journalist thing of people who suggest that music journalists are failed musicians of starting a number of bands.
Well, not a number.
A couple.
One really, and one other sort of musical project thing. It's a fair point. You know, it's a thing always said about rock journalists that they're frustrated rock musicians. It's balls. We're just not. And until I decided, for reasons which had nothing to do with anything in the book, to actually form a band at the age of, when was it, 2006? Anyway, comfortably into my mid-30s, and I decided I was going to form a band. Up until the moment I decided I was going to do that, I honestly never once had any inkling of wanting to do it. I mean, when you see up close what life is like for a band like U2, say, you can see, yeah, okay, this looks like fun. You know, if I could just fill in a form and do this for a job, totally. But that's not what happens to most musicians. For most musicians, and now more so than ever, it's hard. It's really, really tough. And I have a great many friends who are musicians, certainly successful by the standards of most musicians, but And living the dream, in fact, by the standards of most musicians, people who can fill theatres in most big cities in the world. But they did not, at any level, lead a life that I envy at all. It's tough, and it is really, really hard. But it's a different. I will say that it has been. I've made one album with my own band, The Blazing Zoos. We've nearly finished our second album. The other album to which I contributed, which was the North Sea Scrolls with Luke Haynes and Cathal Coughlan, I didn't really. My contribution to the recording of it was to nip out every so often and get coffee for everybody, because I merely recorded the spoken word interludes between the tracks, and we recorded those in Luke's flat. So at the actual studio, I was really, I was coffee guy. Basically. But making the two albums with my band, though we have had a grown-up producer for both, Mark Wallace, who most excitingly for me has produced records for the Go-Betweens and mm-hmm. Paul Kelly, but has worked with everybody ever. That has been instructive. If you've made a lot of your living passing judgment on other people's albums, I'm not saying it should be made compulsory, but it is a useful and interesting thing to do, to have a whack at making one of your own. You do end up listening to other albums quite differently, because I think until you've actually done that, I think there's a, it's like with books as well, or any finished artifact, the thing is the thing, mm-hmm. and it's very hard to imagine it could have been any other thing, because that's the thing. Mm-hmm. But when you actually make the record and you're involved in those endless, uncountable, often incredibly tedious decisions about whether the guitar should be a bit louder in that bit or whether we need an extra drum fill in that bit, you realise that every great record you listen to, all those songs you really love, they're all a collection of those decisions. And you just wonder, if any one of those had been the wrong decision, would it have completely undone this record? Because, you know, to make a genuinely great record, mm. and I'm certainly not accusing myself of having done so yet anyway, a lot of stuff needs to go right, and a lot of stuff needs to not go wrong, and you need quite an intense concentration of people not making stupid decisions. Mm-hmm. And once you sort of experience that up close, then yeah, every completely perfect song does seem like even more of a miracle than it already did.
And all of that must, I mean, that must feed then into your writing about music as well, subsequently?
Well, yes and no. It does when you've got space, which is, and room to sort of think and flex a bit, which unfortunately these days you very often don't. There's only so much you can do with a 100-word album review, for example.
Well, the empathy, at least, I mean. You have more of an understanding of what it's like to create the stuff.
Well, the empathy, well, it's arguable whether that's a good thing. In a rock journalist, because one of the things that certainly appealed to me about Melody Maker when I was young was that old school iconoclasm of the British music press, which Melody Maker did rather pride itself on taking to extremes. I think in the book I say that the difference between the NME and us was that the NME saw themselves principally as cheerleaders, whereas we saw ourselves more as bouncers. You know, we decided who was good. And if we decided that you weren't up to it, then you were getting heaved down the stairs with no great ceremony. I think unless you are actually sociopathic, age takes that out of you a little bit when you start to realise, well, you know, all someone's done here is made a bad pop record. Mm. You know, I mean, really, am I going? And you know, and then you realise, yeah, and people work hard on these, and blah blah blah. And ideally, you should get nicer as you get older. I think most people do, because there is the thing about, you know, obviously, and this was the interesting thing about revisiting this period personally, is this is the period in your life at which you get to think you know everything. Mm-hmm. You're sort of, yeah, especially your early mid-20s, you think you know everything, and then I think the rest of life is largely a process of understanding that, no, you didn't. And in fact, the older you get, the less you realise that you actually understand about anything. So hopefully that makes you a bit humbler and a bit more empathetic. But I do think that music journalism, which isn't really my problem anymore, does miss, and I think music itself suffers from the absence of that kind of, I'll dignify it with the word, rigour. I mean, I did notice that there's been a real generational shift in that recently Luke Haynes, who I just mentioned, and who does also write about music very well, as indeed he writes great, great songs, but he reviewed for a website whose name I can't remember, but he reviewed Noel Gallagher's dreadful last solo record, gave it the thrashing it richly deserved. And it wasn't that people on social media were angry about it in the way that people used to write to us when they were angry that we'd given a battering to their favourite band. Mm-hmm. People were just astonished. People just seemed genuinely surprised that this was allowed, that you could insult the work of, you know, a major artist. There did seem to be a certain amount of nervousness about reaction to it. People said, well, is that permitted? Can you do that?
Well, you mentioned there, you know, the idea of rigour, and certainly, again, you know, when I was reading the music press back in the day, you know, you had the impression that the people who were writing it were curating, that they knew what they were talking about, and therefore you would...
I'm glad you gave that impression.
You would take the word. Well, I'm going to turn that around, because one of the things we said right at the beginning, of the interview was this idea that nowadays, you know, young people who are starting out in writing are not allowed those errors. You know, they're not allowed to say something like out there and passionate and upsetting without getting sort of torn down. And actually, when I think about it, really, I say, you know, it felt like everyone knew what they were talking about. But the music press to me seemed like it was that, like young people saying actually quite ridiculous bullshit a lot of the time.
We had the certain measure of youth, you know, your standard issue youthful fearlessness, on top of which we had the arrogance which came from being provided with a fairly well-read platform in which to parade it. And we did also have that... We didn't have that pressure of the instant response. Mm-hmm. I mean, occasionally, you know, you would get someone writing into you saying, oh, you're even at the same gig. But the thing is, if someone wanted to write in and tell you you were a wanker, which occasionally they did, they'd have to find some paper, remember where the pen was, and they'd have to find an envelope, and who's ever got an envelope. And then so once I go to the shop, get an envelope, come back, write the letter, find out what Melody Maker's address is, and bugger, I've thrown the issue away, I have to wait till next week. Wait till next week, ah, there's the address, fine. Walk to the post office, stay in the queue. By the time someone gets to the front of that queue, most people just thought, oh, Christ, what was I even upset about? So you basically only used to get letters from people who were really passionate and who basically wanted to write for Melody Maker or were mad, mm-hmm. not to put too fine a point on it. So, but you didn't get the instant response. And I think that, unless you are an absolutely dauntless sociopath, is daunting. I find it daunting. I've more than once, you know, you'll tap onto Twitter something that seems like a sort of amusing, whimsical, pertinent aside to some discussion, and then just find yourself thinking, I can't be bothered dealing with the consequences mm-hmm. of that. And, you know, and as I was saying earlier, I've been doing this a long time. My interest in what other people think of my own opinions is barely measurable. So I think if you're a younger person who is probably still under the bluster and arrogance and fearlessness of youth, somewhat anxious and fractured as young people tend to be, yeah, I can imagine that a certain amount, actually I imagine a great deal of self-censorship, if not admitted or witting, does go on. Because I think everybody must have, I do catch myself doing it. You just think, is making this joke or expressing this opinion worth having to deal with what the consequences are going to be? Because the same people who, well, because you used to have to do all the stuff of finding the paper in the envelope, whereas now any idiot with a telephone can respond instantly mm-hmm. right there. And I think that has had an inhibiting effect on criticism, possibly, ironically, in the same way that criticism maybe had an inhibiting effect on... Actually, no, I don't think criticism had an inhibiting effect on music, so why do I think this has an inhibiting effect on criticism? Maybe this thought makes no sense at all.
That's a good point for us to finish, I think. I've been talking to Andrew Muller. We've been talking about his book, It's Too Late to Die Young Now, Misadventures in Rock and Roll. It's been out for ages, hasn't it?
It's been out
in the UK.
It's been out in Australia since 2013, and I believe is still available in all good bargain bins. It's been out in the UK since about late-ish 2014, so it's still reasonably current. Certainly available, published by Ferruli, so available exclusively online, so Amazon would be the swiftest way to purchase it. Not out on ebook yet, but at least one of my other books is other titles available, etc.
Andrew, thank you very much for telling me about it.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.